It's me and you.
Peak of motion.
Yeah, yeah.
It's tried and true.
Welcome to EcoMotion Conversations. I'm Ted Flanagan, and with me today is Michael Ware, a fellow EcoMotion employee. He's our senior solar specialist. EcoMotion's mission is the cost-effective greening of cities, corporations, and campuses. For these podcasts, we'll be focusing on people in motion. In fact, EcoMotion's theme song, the refrain is EcoMotion, People in Motion. These podcasts are going to shed light on and get insights from leading green thinkers. Their works, their passions. What keeps your engine charged? Michael, welcome to the podcast. We've been working together for 10 years, or almost 10
almost
years.
Almost 10 years, yes.
And that's a long time to have worked together. And I was reflecting back, I think, to when we very first met at maybe Alt Build in Santa Monica.
Correct.
And you somehow came up to me and said you were interested in sort of a change up in your career. What was going on in your head back then?
Well, I had decided that my previous career had played itself out. I was writing for television, and it just became more and more frustrating to compete with all the younger writers to chase fewer and fewer jobs, it seemed to me. So I really took a year to think about where I wanted to go, and renewables and climate were very attractive to me. And I kind of got to solar because I was interested in electric cars. I thought that was the wave of the future. And then I wondered where all this power was going to come from. And I read some articles talking about solar energy. And then solar kind of took over and became more preeminent in my mind. And I thought that was really the thing to jump on and investigate. And I wanted to pick something that would, you know, take me into retirement, which I keep thinking is farther and farther away.
I'm glad
yeah.
to hear that.
Yeah. It became fascinating to me, and so I wanted to learn more about it. So I was reading and going to events, and I learned about Solar Santa Monica, and then I learned about this Alt-Built symposium. It was at the airport.
Yeah.
At Barker Hangar.
The hangar. I remember that.
Santa Monica. And you were on the dais as well as Stuart Cooley, who was the energy efficiency engineer in Santa Monica. And so I went to both of you afterwards and said, hey, what do I do? I'm really interested in this industry. You took me over to, there was Purvis City booth, and you introduced me to Herb Mendelson.
I remember that. Yeah.
And suggested that I, ask the same questions of Herb. And, Stuart was very interested in me. As it turned out later, Stuart was really more interested in developing his own comedy skills. And he liked the fact that I was a comedy writer. So, he definitely befriended me and we talked. But, that was the genesis of it.
Yeah. So then you did go to Perma City.
I did.
Maybe even a few weeks thereafter and started to work for a solar company.
My thought was that I would just make myself available. I would volunteer. I wanted to learn, and I had no compunction about just, lending my time and getting inside and finding out how it worked. I figured with my skill set, I would aim at sales. I don't have a technical background. I don't have an engineering background. And I assumed that that's kind of the positioning. It would be, selling solar and extolling its benefits, not working on increasing cell efficiency, for a German scientific or engineering.
Well, but how did that go? I mean, I know you were there for about a year. I like to tell people it wasn't your cup of tea, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was your cup of tea.
It wasn't that it wasn't my cup of tea, but it was an interesting company. John Port is runs Perma City, and it's amazing how far that company has developed, because when I worked with them, he was literally using the space of his wife's botanical garden and nursery. It was literally outdoors between two buildings, and he had some awnings to provide shade, and that was his office. But I was just trying really hard to understand everything. And one great thing about being a permacity was all the reps would come by. So, you know, the rep from Sharp Solar would come and do a little symposium about what made their cells better. And then maybe somebody from an inverter company would come, and from racking companies. So it was a great way to learn inside. What I started doing from Herb was mostly the paperwork that was annoying him. There was a number of steps you would do to analyze somebody's potential rebate, and I began taking over that work for him. And then Herb was in the process of doing a lot of little symposiums. He would buy people like a real estate office or architect office and say, "Hey, I'll bring you lunch." He'd bring a tray of Subway sandwiches and, you know, let me give you my solar pitch and tell you why you should work with us when you're developing for your client. So I would join him on those expeditions or go pick up the sandwiches and meet him and help him. There were a number of really talented people in the company, and I started learning more and more. They were also part of the Solar Santa Monica program. And while I worked for them, I continued to volunteer for Solar Santa Monica as well. And that's when, you know, I had lunch with your brother, Russell. Yeah, and he gave me a lot of tips and pointers, and at that time you were very open to volunteers. Not that you aren't now. There's probably just a common theme with you. You were open to volunteers. So I would come in the booth. There was often something at a farmer's market or an event, and I would just help hand out literature and answer people's basic questions, because now I'm fairly good at answering basic questions. If they don't get too technical, I can guide homeowners through the steps to going solar and the values and so forth. So I think that positioned me well so that when Russell left and you did have a job opening, I was familiar to you. I was familiar to the people at Solar Santa Monica, like Susan Mundvis. And I kind of like the idea of moving from sales to, the more objective voice, or just kind of the role that EcoMotion plays in general, being the owner's rep and not having to sell as much as just, you know, explain and guide and be a little more, open about the values of lots of different products and lots of different suppliers. So that appealed to me.
The owners, the honest broker, as we like to call
it.
Right. And before we lose the point, I mean, this whole notion of volunteering at organizations where you want to work or in industries where you want to work, I think really needs to be underscored. I know there's a financial reality that not everybody can volunteer, but it seems like a very important point is that if you know where you want to go, that you just immerse yourself in that and make yourself valuable, make yourself known, as you did, because when Russell moved off to Vermont, it was obvious that even despite your penchant for using the Solar Pathfinder, an antiquated technology, it was obvious that you were the right guy. So you came to EcoMotion. It's been almost 9 years. We talked about the honest broker role that we've had. We don't sell anything other than our services, our intelligence. And what would you say would have been your biggest accomplishments? I mean, when you think about the 10 years and you think about what you've done and all the people that you've touched, which projects or aspects of the job bubble up to the top?
Well, kind of a couple of things. One, in my personal growth, just mastering some big projects. And one of the first big projects was we had an opportunity to help, the Capital Group go solar in Irvine. And that was, we were starting our analysis in 2009. So I hadn't been with the company. It was about a year and a half at that point. And that was a pretty big project. And so, you know, there we're doing financial calculations for a financial company. So you'd think that they would, you know, be real sticklers about, you know, what we were doing. But by that time, I was able to, you know, assess their situation. I knew enough about you know, how solar performed. I knew enough about the type of rates. They were all SCE meters and rates, and I knew enough about that solar performance. I was beginning to jump on pieces of information that were going to make it more valuable, like understanding the value of option R. It was all kind of coming together at that time. In fact, option R was being promulgated. Well, I won't even say that. It wasn't even being pushed. It was suddenly revealed in the summer of 2009 to no fanfare. And I think I was one of the early recognizers that, hey, there's this great thing that is going to make solar pay off a lot better. And it was very satisfying helping organize that project. And you know, we put out an RFP and had a lot of the top companies bidding for that job. And we were involved in the selection process and wound up finding, you know, a company that really did them a good job. That was a funny thing because if you remember in that project, there were kind of the codes and covenants of the Irvine company, or
yeah,
and they didn't want to see
can't
modules.
See any solar anywhere.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. So Drew, my colleague, and I were up on the shade structures that existed already, putting sample modules and then scooting them back to see at what point they wouldn't be visible from the street. And I remember taking my son's little wooden block set up there with me so I could mount the solar panels and say, okay, how far could they stand off the shade structures and not be seen, and how far would the setback have to be? So it was just, that was a great project to plunge into. So that was one thing that I thought was a good accomplishment. And another, hopefully it's still working to this day, was helping the Santa Monica School District get solar, because they had put it out an RFP and only had two companies respond, and both of them responded to it with a price that was going to be far more than they were paying in electricity bills now. So it just foundered. And when we got involved, kind of through the Solar Santa Monica program to take a look at this, we realized that with the advent of Option R, there might be a middle ground, and you know, we helped create that, and then made board presentations and did analysis so that the board could be comfortable about moving forward, and it ultimately provided, you know, 3/4 of a megawatt to 9 elementary schools in the district. So,
you know, you raised this point a couple times with Option R.
Yeah.
And it really underscores the importance of understanding rate structures, because, you know, most people think you got a good roof, or you got a good parking lot for solar, or you got a place to put a ground mount system.
Mm-hmm.
That's half the equation, right? Where you put it, and then what's the value of the offset? And you've really become probably never thought you would become this knowledgeable about utility rates.
No, it reminds me of you know, one job I had going through college was a night auditor at hotels. And the night auditor usually is the one who, at the time anyway, would post the charges on each room, and then you would have to make sure that everything was in balance. And it would be maddening because it would be 3 a.m. and you'd be off by a nickel, and you'd comb carefully through every certain ledger, every single ledger, to find that nickel. And so we're going through utility rates and looking at the tariff sheets, and where you've got, you know, rates in different categories that are out to the 12 decimal, and looking for the value. It's a real intricate process, but
and one that always changes. I mean, that's
yeah.
One of the things that you and I've talked about is that the economics of solar deals are based on, in large part, on the rate that's offset. And yet there's no guarantee that rate is going to be in place over the life of, certainly over the life of the solar system, 20, 25 years. So.
Exactly. Well, you know, yeah, rates have become a big component. And, you know, there's so much variation in all the 50 states. And then one of the big variations is the way they're served. You know, it's either by a municipal utility or an owned utility. And there are different rate structures and different policies, and it can be so different. And So the devil really is in the details. And one thing that I've come to discover, and this really surprises me, is how many customers, how many businesses, certainly how many residents, really have no idea how their power bill works. And to me, that would be the first point of understanding. If I want to reduce my bill, either through, you know, becoming more efficient or deciding when I should use power or not, or, you know, how I could affect it in terms of what I pay, I would pay close attention to that. And it shocks me that most people don't. I think I call it spreadsheet-itis, that maybe CEOs don't look at their bills. They see a bottom line that's already, you know, it's averaged in some different way that really makes sense for the way they use power. And so they know what a general cost is, but they really haven't thought about it in terms of its ultimate impact on the bottom line, how they could affect it.
Right, and then I sort of fast forward that to this day and age when we're looking, when we look going to a corporate site or a school site or municipal facility, you know, we're thinking in terms of energy efficiency. We're thinking in terms of that loading order that comes from the PUC. What can we conserve first? That's the cheapest thing to do. Then how can we layer on some solar? How does that offset various rates? Now we've got storage that adds a whole other, really, it's another level of complexity to the equation. And I know that we have sophisticated software to sort that all out. But back to the owner of a facility or this chief financial officer that doesn't even understand his power bill, how do we go from that place of relative naivety to getting them into a really comprehensive energy deal? Pretty tricky stuff.
Yeah, it is. And sometimes it's the industry people who have to take the lead. That for instance, the rage in energy storage at the moment is demand rate clipping. So they say, you know, that's one thing that people fail to understand, that a good portion of their bill is not with the amount of electricity they use, but how much of it they use at a particular time that kind of sets the peak for them. And so, you know, you could be averaging, let's say, 100 kilowatt of demand, but there's, you know, at noon on Friday, it spikes up to 130 and then back down. And so the energy storage companies are saying, we can address that and clip that peak, so, you know, you're just using your battery at that moment, not demanding more from the power company. So we'll cap your expenditure at, you know, 100 kilowatts times the rate, not 130, and that's where they've been training people. You know, you can look at this. We can help you. So I think it's often led by the industry. The industry will find out what's working and how they can penetrate and make their deals.
And then it's that communication with the customer, getting that customer comfortable with moving forward or comfortable taking a third-party financing scheme. Well, what about, we talked a little bit about accomplishments, and you talked about Capital Group and the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. You know, when you reflect back, what were some of the challenges that, I don't know if they kept you up at night or, you know, I mean, here's this burgeoning industry, everybody wants to go solar, we're in sunny Southern California. You know, what are some of the things that you've seen that have really hampered the industry?
Well, I would say that cost is the main thing, of course, but that has so reduced in this industry that it's people are having the same battle, but they're having it on a, you know, at a lower level. I mean, when I started, the going rate for probably residential cost was about $10 a watt, and maybe commercial was more like $6 or $7 a watt. And that has plummeted down to, you know, under $2 a watt for commercial and $3 a watt for residential. And so, you know, people have talked about reducing the cost to the point where solar becomes comparable to other types of generation. And I feel like we're there already. And that then the market takes over. It's not the company that gets the most U.S. subsidy or the company that can take advantage of particular incentives in different areas. It's almost like everybody can take advantage of it.
Well, so we saw the cost come skyrocketing down. I mean, like the residential system that cost $10 10 years ago,
yeah,
is probably $3 now, something like that. And commercial systems even in the $2 a watt range. But we also saw in that same time frame, we saw the California Solar Initiative, the infamous CSI, mm-hmm. go through its degressive incentives structure.
Yes,
where those incentives dropped away. We've seen the investment tax credit kind of hang in there, although we thought that it was going to be taken away, that 30% tax credit. Now it's on a calendar going down. We've had depreciation benefits change. We had double accelerated depreciation about 5 years ago. There's always all these changes that change the economics of a deal. And now is this whole proposal by the utilities to shift the peak periods. And to move the peak periods that we all as consumers pay the most power, the highest price for, to move it into the sort of late afternoon and early evening and missing most of the solar production. So, is that frustrating to you as a person when we have all these variables, or is that just all part of this challenge?
Well, it's certainly all part of the challenge. The frustrating part is just when you've explored a sweet spot that you can, you know, recommend and you think that, hey, as long as the option R exists, this is the way to go. And then you find out, oh, well, that's on a capacity that's going to expire. So then there'll have to be something beyond that. And then, you know, maybe this is a great time for the utilities to start thinking, well, if we need to shift our the way we charge for power based on the way people consume it and what's available, and as we shift to later time periods, like literally talking about moving the peak from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m., moving it to 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. So that's quite a shift, and it takes it uncomfortably out of the hours when solar is most potent. So I think that the benefactor will be the storage industry, because they've got the means to, you know, store it when you generate it, and then dispatch it when the sun isn't shining. So I think that will be a boon to the storage industry.
Although more cost to, I mean, just obviously more cost to our clients that need to not only go solar, but to add storage to that.
True.
So, interesting. What about SPI? You were just in Vegas last week or the week before at Solar Power International, and as you cruise the floor, mm-hmm. What's going through your mind?
Well, one is how many players and aspects are out of the show. There were over 700 exhibitors there, so it was a big show. And you kind of just by walking around, you get a sense for who are the big players in any one aspect. You know, who are the biggest booths in displaying their modules, in their inverters, in the racking. You know, technology and in batteries, so you get a sense of that, and you start to see players emerge. Like maybe 5 years ago, I didn't know who Trina Solar was, and now they're like number one, and they have a huge booth and a huge outreach to, you know, all of their customers. So you get a sense for, you know, who's up and who's down in the industry, or who's resurging. Solar World was not the last show I went, but they were at this show, so I think maybe they're trying to make a comeback. So you get a sense for that. You get a sense for the scale, too, that so much of solar development is on the utility side, that, you know, utilities are buying 20 megawatt, 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt, you know, plants. And so, you know, there's a good portion of the industry that is sort of aimed at that kind of development. So you're looking at companies that are incapable of putting down ground mounts that cover, you know, 50 acres, and then they're going to host solar panels. And, you know, one of the top solar panel manufacturers is First Solar, and as you know, they're atypical because they're not PV. It's the thin film solar, and so
yeah, not the crystalline, but it's the amorphous.
Right, and they're one of the top 10 manufacturers, but you don't see them on buildings. You don't see them on homes. It's almost all utility scale. and you'd think, wow, there's a massive market that we don't...
Well, does that make you think that we'll go towards a utility scale sort of predominance, or do you think we'll continue to have a mix of utility scale and then sort of distributed generation, rooftop, sort of net metered stuff?
Yeah. I think that we would continue to have a mix of different things. I certainly see it growing on the utility scale side. It just makes more sense in terms of the amount of power we consume as a nation, and that while there are benefits for homeowners to have solar and for businesses to have solar, in general, if you can take a big 50 megawatt or 100 megawatt plant and have that maximizing the production on that plant, you know, I mean, they do it by adjusting the tilt or following the sun, or, you know, they can maximize it. So I think that's very helpful. And same thing with storage on that side, on that scale, it's important. I was just reminded again, driving back from Las Vegas, and you pass the giant, amazing looking Ivanpah towers that are using the mirrors to reflect the sunlight for concentrated solar. Just the scale of that is really interesting to me, even though I think that they may have some issues like everybody else with, wow, solar's gotten so cheap that even this technology maybe is a little bit too expensive. But and then at the same time, it seems to me that more people are interested in being self-sufficient and having a power source that they can depend on and looking beyond just solar on their roof, but adding storage and even contemplating microgrids so that they've got... It's funny to me that so many people thought they had power just because they had solar panels, that when the grid went down, they would continue to operate. And then they discover, oh, that doesn't work that way.
Disappointing.
Yeah. But now there are more and more means to allow people to do that, either by a single inverter that's capable of, you know, running an extension cord too, if you want to power a few things, to designing your home to be a microgrid and to island, as they say, and just operate independently when the grid goes down. So I think there'll always be that kind of demand too. I hope it grows exponentially in all categories. That would be great.
I think it seems that it really is happening right in front of our eyes. Let's use the last few minutes of this podcast to get a little bit of insight, you know, into who you are, what makes you tick, and where were you born and raised?
In California. I moved around as a little kid, so I was in the Bay Area, in Oakland, and Berkeley, and Hayward, and Fremont. I went to high school in the Central Coast, in Santa Maria, and then I left the state to go to school. I went to school in Texas and Louisiana for my undergraduate degree. And I really missed California. So even though my family moved away, I decided I would, after college, I would definitely come back. And so I did. In 1976, I came back to LA. And I don't see why people don't live anywhere else. I mean, everybody should live right here. But that's where traffic comes from.
So who were your... that is where traffic comes from, and smog and all those nasties. But who really influenced you? Do you have any mentors in your life that you can point to, or not?
Well, I would say that some of my college experiences helped shape me. In fact, when I was in school, I participated in speech and debate activities. In college, I was on the debate team. And the last year when I was a senior, the debate topic was about energy supply. A debate topic is always affirmatively worded. Resolve that the United States should control the supply and utilization of energy. And then it launches an enormous amount of research because, you know, more than needing that information to pass a test or get a good grade, you need that information so you won't be humiliated in a debate round. So it really forces people to study. And I think that period of time when I didn't know anything about anything about energy, and I learned a lot about utility grids, and I learned about solar, and I learned about hydrogen-based economy. There were lots of different aspects to it, and so years later, when it came time to think, wow, what would I like to do? I would drift back to those memories and those thoughts, and like, whatever did happen to that hydrogen economy I was talking about? Where is it? Where is solar now? And I kind of embraced that, those. So I would say that my years as a debater probably had more impact on me than my years as a college student. So I was kind of grateful to the opportunity to do that and travel and explore these topics. 1 year it was medical care, 1 year it was information gathering, and 1 year it was energy. So it was always very interesting.
And you live in Santa Monica, and I just love the story of, and you've got a great wife and 3 kids, and I love the story of you guys buying the bigger house.
Oh.
And then deciding that wasn't the quality of life that you wanted, and you came back to the little house. And
well, it's true. I hadn't thought about it. It looked also appealing, so big and shiny. And then you realize, wow, this is like a hike from my bedroom down to the kitchen. And even the giant kitchen with a giant center console that had burners and sinks, and you'd have to walk all the way around to the refrigerator and then all the way back. And, we hadn't been there long enough to truly furnish the house, but we kind of felt lost, like we were in a big cavern a little bit. So it didn't feel cozy. And so when it came time to decide which house that we wanted to hang on to, the one that we had, our 1,000-foot square foot house that we were renting, or this 3,600-square-foot house that we were buying, we thought we like the little one. It was cozy, so that we went back to that. Yeah.
And what I know, you got the kids are a huge part of your life and supporting your wife's teaching. But what would you say fires you up on a daily basis? What is it that gets you going?
Well, I'm kind of a political junkie. I'm addicted to Rachel Maddow and MSNBC, and certainly all the things that are going on right now really, really get my blood going. And so every day I'm looking for new evidence that insanity will be vanquished. So I'm kind of following the whole Trump investigation, which is... That's why I want to see in the paper in the morning. What's new?
Yeah.
So I get a kick out of following all that, and maybe like everybody else in the country, living in Santa Monica where it's so vastly liberal. Yeah. At least I have the comfort of being surrounded by like-minded people. Yeah. If I saw a Trump sign in somebody's lawn, I probably would have a fit.
Well, very good. That's probably a good place to leave it. I think this has been a great conversation, and I thank you deep down, not just for this conversation, but for everything you've done. It's you're not only a very talented individual, but you're a nice guy to be around, and you got a lot of humor and humility that I think go a long way. So thank you for being you and for joining us here today.
Thanks. We'll do 10 more years at EcoMotion.
Very good.
EcoMotion is me and you. EcoMotion, yeah, yeah, it's tried and true.